So, welcome back to Thoughtful Penny. This is Brian Penny, your podcast host. And hold on one second here. All right, make sure everything's going live on. We should be both on YouTube and on Spotify right now. Hold on real quick while I figure this out. Make sure that we are. So, right, yeah, everything's going good. It's some kind of stream problem somewhere on the video, but it is all good. So, today we're going to talk about how I became a freelance writer. And it was a big transition for me. It was a Going from a management position in a middle management position in corporate America to a freelance position in my home on my own, which kind of I don't know, it was an interesting transition. It was difficult to say the least. Getting used to this corporate structure and then going from that into a structured or an unstructured environment was something that I didn't really understand what I was doing at the beginning. I made a lot of mistakes basically getting into it. When I started out, I already understood the concept. I guess I did some things right too. I understood the concept of ownership of your content, and that's something I mean, to this day, still getting into my becoming a problem in my career, essentially. If you go back and watch some of the earlier live streams, I've got one talking about New Times and where they attempted to kind of take control over my content that had nothing to do with them, and then they're not the first. I mean, several people have throughout my career attempted to take control. And I mean, the blog that I started, my own blog on Thought for Your Penny, was easily the first mainstream, or the first, I guess, writing thing that I did. And that was my independent channel. That was me going through and basically learning on my own how to do everything, how to write, how to make some kind of story structure, the basic business of blogging. By the time so that first summer was basically just me blogging on my own blog, getting everything set up and just kind of trying to figure out like what my voice is, who I am, what it is that I'm gonna do with my career, what I'm gonna say. And there was it was a learning curve. I mean, I was writing about myself, so kind of what the problem was I was always so used to, I just don't like the idea of fame. I was always so used to being anonymous and being, especially online, where nobody knew who I was. And so suddenly putting my name on everything and writing in public was something that took some getting used to. I mean, getting inside deep into yourself and I mean, there's a level of bravery it's hard to describe that it takes for somebody to, like Eminem, to put all of his personal business in front of everybody. I mean, the guy's got like 1 billion people that are buying his records, and he's talking about his daughter, his wife, his mom. Everybody knows about all the women in the man's family. And those are the kind of things that, I mean, it gets scary. Eminem, for example, just had a guy who was stalking him for a while. It was basically hunting him down. And I mean, that guy. Those kind of things happen, and those are the kind of things that you have to be worried about whenever you're putting yourself on camera in public. You're putting yourself out there. Personally, this is why I use this one wall back here, because I try to make it as generic, I guess, as possible, so that you can't really see what's inside my house. It's interesting to me to see like Saturday Night Live, for example, when they have the Saturday Night Live at home and all these people are showing their houses. Out of all of them, Pete Davidson probably stuck out the most because he was showing essentially his mom's house. He lives in the basement of his mom's house, and he's showing a lot of information about it. And he seems like the type that would have the Eminem style fans, although they wouldn't actually probably be Eminem fans because MGK and Eminem had their little beef, and Pete Davidson is clearly on MGK's side. But I mean, despite that, he seems like he would have the same type of people that would get drunk or stoned or whatever drugs and stand out on him. And that's the kind of thing that I was never into that whole thing. So it was difficult for me to get. I mean, we're at 10 years now that I've been doing this, and I've barely just started putting myself on camera. I've done it a few times, but it was rare, far, few and far between. When you look at the most popular video that has my face actually on it on this channel was about living in a van. It was basically I wasn't even in the van. I didn't want to film inside my van. I was terrified of filming inside my van because I didn't want people to find out, you know, what it was actually like in there, and track me down or get in any kind of trouble. And so I did it from a room I was renting off of Craigslist is where I actually filmed that first set of videos that I put on here. And that was it's about 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. And I mean, those videos were and definitely the reason that the van dwelling thing went the way that it did, and it got some traction. I mean, it was only like 30,000 views, but it got those views because on the back of me basically being real about what it's like to actually live in a van and not trying to show off the van life, the hashtag van life, and trying to make it look like it was more glamorous than it really is. And I mean, that was basically the key to the success of that video was the honesty. And that is something that you have to do. I mean, when you're creating content of any kind, you have to be honest. And there's kind of a I don't know, there's a line between media and marketing, and it's funny because as a writer, you cross both of those lines all the time. I don't know any writer that sticks just to journalist. Well, I know a few actually, but for the most part, people go between journalism and marketing all the time. When I was doing it, I mean, when I started my initial blog, it was all about whistleblowing. It was all about activism, Anonymous, Occupy. It was at the beginning of all that stuff, and that's what I was really following a lot of. And as I got through, as you know, time went on, and I got into the business more, and I had to start paying my bills, it became clear that there's going to have to be two versions of me too. There's going to be have to be the me in public, and there's going to have to be the ghostwriter version of me. And that's where I mean, even before I started writing for HuffPost was the first major place I was writing for. But even before that, I was already ghostwriting for several different people. And that was when actually when HuffPost picked me up, it was because of whistleblowing. And you can hear the whistleblowing story on the previous episode of this podcast. But basically, I mean, I leaked some information from Bank of America's corporate emails, basically, to show that they were purposely foreclosing on houses. And in doing so, I basically burned down every bridge that I created over my 20s. So I had to spend, I mean, on my 30th birthday, this is when it was a little bit after my 30th birthday, it was about a month after when I quit Bank of America. And you know, I spent my 30s building up an entirely new career. Hold on, I'm gonna hit this weed real quick. Gotta perk me up a little bit. I'm a little tired right It's been a long day. So, I mean, initially, it was just me blogging for myself, and there was really nobody that was reading it. Eventually, people started reading it, and I mean, I was very focused heavily on. And a lot of the stuff that I was blowing the whistle on, the forced place insurance, mortgages, all that stuff, on top of just the act of whistleblowing and any kind of activism. And it got to a point where I started to get traction, basically. And Huffington Post was one of the first places that invited me to guest post with them. And I was flattered. I mean, the Huffington Post was, even at the time, was a large business, and it was still being run by Arianna Huffington at the time also. And the opportunity that it afforded me was just couldn't be ignored, basically. There was no way that I was going to look a gift horse in the mouth. And I mean, they gave me Well, first they let me submit my article, and it was the very first article that I wrote was actually it was related to the whistleblowing I was doing at the time. I was going through and trying to lobby to fix everybody's bills to basically have your escrow account show up on your mortgage bill and get everything, just the regulations fixed for that. And they, I mean, it went well for the most part. I was writing about just to solicit people to get in there basically and participate, hopefully to try to get more numbers, more consumer numbers to counteract the because it was mostly mortgage people. When it comes down to it, the mortgage and insurance companies are the only people that actually care about the mortgage and insurance lobbying. If you everybody has one of these. It's one of the things that I've learned over the years is that everybody has a mortgage and insurance, but nobody really knows how any of that stuff works. And it was too difficult to try to explain it. There was nobody that was going to listen, and that wasn't against me essentially. So I realized pretty quickly that I needed to do something else. Once I had written a few articles on the Huffington Post, and I mean, I'd also gotten in a few other places, but at that point I was also writing for the Street, and the Street had picked me up pretty regularly. They were paying. Still a great amount right now. It was $250 for every article, and I mean, I was turning in about 1,000 to 1,500 word articles, give or take, on MainStreet.com at the time, which all got rolled into the Street. And that is Jim Cramer, the Mad Money guy, the Jim Cramer's outlet, the Street. And the Street was his online brand that he gives out all of his investment advice, and then the Main Street was for all of the personal finance stuff for the average person on Main Street. And that's what I was writing for initially, was a bunch of finance stuff using my my old job as fodder basically. And that was fine. I mean, at the time, that's what I was looking to do. I was really interested in affecting mortgage regulations, so I was taking every job that I could that had anything to do with finance that I could tell people like the dirty secrets of the mortgage companies and the banking industry and the finance industry and insurance and all that. And I reached a point eventually where, I mean, you start to spend so much time talking about your old job that it just becomes too negative. I mean, the mortgage industry, even to this day, I mean, when you watch The Big Short, you see what happens in the mortgage-backed securities, and they never really stopped. They renamed it. They keep doing it. They repackaged it, and all that stuff's still going on. What I was blowing the whistle on was forced place insurance, and forced place insurance is still going on. So to this day, this is how they're going to end up, foreclosing on people and kicking people out of their homes over the next few months as this year goes on in this quarantine. And it became very clear to me that I was playing a game that they controlled all the cards. They were the house. The house was going to win. There was no way that I was going to beat this impossible battle. And I did inevitably, I mean, I still do use the whistleblowing hook to kind of reel in publications. And as things went on, basically I would pull in major outlets like Huffington Post, Wired, Cracked, High Times, Forbes, Fast Company, all these places, and I would do articles with them so that I could continue to promote my blog essentially. But my blog, I mean, I had long ago moved on from that whistleblowing story. So I mean, there's only so many ways you can continuously explain the. I mean, it's like if you break up with your ex, you get a divorce, and you don't want to keep fucking talking about that same person. You eventually just want to move on to a new job, a new career. And I mean, at the time, I got lucky that what was going on was it was right when I was writing for the Street for Jim Cramer. Cannabis got legalized in Washington and Colorado, and at the time, I mean. Those were the first two states. This was a huge thing. Even though medicinal marijuana still existed in the U.S. up to that point, it was still kind of a like behind closed doors thing that you needed to have some kind of a membership basically to get in, and I mean, in order to do that, you had to have a medical condition. And once it was legalized, I mean, it became a huge thing. Even though it was just in those two states, obviously money started piling into those two states. So Jim Cramer had actually assigned me to kind of look through some cannabis stuff. They knew that I was a pothead. I mean, when I quit my job, I'd stayed home and I drank a bunch of liquor and I got a bunch of weed as I watched my entire fucking life falling apart. And I mean, that's what I used to fuel, kind of put a barrier in my head so that I could focus on work and not on all the things that were going on. And so, I mean, it was a really easy transition to start writing about the legal cannabis industry. That was one of the, I mean, the, I guess I got lucky at that point because it was cannabis and vaping, which this vape pen is a cannabis vape pen, so it's the best of both worlds. And that was the sweet spot of what I knew. I understood vaping from the very beginning because I was a smoker and I used the early vape pens, the very first generation vape pens. And I mean, on top of that, I am a medical marijuana cardholder, and at the time I was not. I was very interested, and I understood the culture I always had. Growing up by the border, it was one of the things that, I mean, we've had a wall and all sorts of stuff. The blimp, the drones, facial recognition, everything that you hear about today that is like this hardcore crazy thing that I can't believe they're monitoring us. But I mean, I grew up by Fort Huachuca, and that's the military capital of the world, basically, well, the US. And I mean, it's our intelligent capital and technology capital, and it's where they tested out the unmanned aerial vehicles at the time. UAVs is what they were called, not drones, but and they still don't like them to be called drones. But that was the time. And hold on, I'm doing a sec. All right, and now we're back. So I started off writing about, I mean, it was basically drugs is what it was, but I mean, there was a bunch of legal companies at the beginning. This was like the 2012 to 2014 range, basically. This was like the prime time when everything, all the money was going into vaping and cannabis. These were both really big industries. And so I not only was writing about them for the street, I was also basically getting non-stop PR pitches for all sorts of companies. So I started, what happened was I had an assignment from Jim Cramer to interview Snoop Dogg's marketing agency. I can't remember the name of that marketing agency off the top of my head right now, but, basically, what was going on was Snoop had just started the Snoopify app. And if you're not aware, the Snoopify app, I don't know if it even still exists. I'm sure it does, but it was a, Instagram filter fucking app. I'm sure it's spread out to more since then, but at the time it was Instagram only. And what it allowed you to do was Snoopify your Instagram photos. So you can take a picture of you and then make it look like there's a rainbow blunt. Like, well, this is a rainbow vape pen, but basically would have the, well, a golden blunt is what they would have, and you would be shooting out a rainbow vape, rainbow smoke by smoking it. And it was funny because that rainbow blunt cost, I believe it was $250, if I remember correctly. And it was funny. I mean, the article that I essentially wrote about that had to point out the fact that, I mean, you could take a real, go to Shine Papers, and they got Shine 24K, 24 karat gold papers. You can get those blunt wraps for like $10, I believe, maybe 20 at the most. And then, I mean, you can go get an eighth of really good weed for easily $100. I mean, for 50, $60 for like the top shelf. And I mean, you can make your own real golden blunt for a pretty decent size, like 3.5 gram fucking golden blunt for half, if even less than half the price of what Snoop is selling it for. And his is just a digital one. It wasn't even real. But at the same time, just by talking to his marketing agency, they had invited me out to his performance. He was pairing up with Wiz Khalifa and shoot, I can't remember also who else was there for a concert for the 420 Cannabis Cup at the time in Denver, Colorado. So I went out there. I slept at this woman's house as a PR rep. Stayed with her for a week. It was an interesting time. She was out finding models and things for the cup she had moved from Texas. There was a lot of money. I mean, there was a huge green rush that was going on at the time. This was a pretty historic event, and I've got out there. I slept in my van actually for the night of the. Well, the second night of the Cannabis Cup, but I mean, we were there for an entire like 2 weeks of total, actually. So there was before everything was going on, we were setting everything up and meeting with the dispensaries and everything like that, and the actual setup of it the day before we went to it and got a tour for the big industry show, which was had the gallery of glass and all sorts of stuff. It was this huge, like it was like $1.5 million worth of glass art, I believe, is what the guy told me. It was the CEO of 420 Wipes was the one who gave me tours. Looked like a Russian gangster, all in fucking Adidas jumpsuits. Totally cool guy though, but you definitely tell that this was like—I mean, nobody was fucking around. This was like 100% professional weed event. And I mean, I got in there as press. I managed to get into the Cannabis Cup as press. I covered everything. I sold the story. By that point, I had picked up Cannabis Now. I started writing for Cannabis Now as well, and I was fully—I mean, deep, pretty deep in the cannabis industry by that point. I mean, it stayed that way for about a year. I went up to. Well, for 2 years, actually. I went up to a couple of cannabis cups in Washington and in Northern California, and I ended up in the harvest season for Oregon. I went there a couple of years. I went back there right after the first time because I had so much fun the first time. But yeah, I ended up just basically going up to it was well Portland and Eugene Springfield, and by that point they were just set to legalize. That they had voted for it and legalized, but they had not actually put the new legalization in there that summer. It was actually that July. I've got a bunch of pictures of it on my blog, but it was the first legalization of in Oregon, recreational legalization day. And what was going on when they first opened everything, they were allowed to have legal recreational weed, but they weren't allowed to sell it. So they basically gave it away. There was a bunch of places that figured out ways to pay for a grow class, and they'll give you a free weed plant and some weed, or you show up for these events. I mean, that's what the pictures I have in there for one of the events a brewery had, where basically you go there, you it was like a mini cannabis cup, but it was all local Oregon growers and dispensaries, and got to pick up a bunch of different weed there. And that was the first time I tried a strawberry Satori. That was a one of the farmers up there had just got it in his genetics. And it's funny because now we're at this year it was a mix. Like last year was strawberry banana was the big one, and then that's the stuff that you most likely gotten like the high end this past year. And then next year is like a strawberry banana blend, rainbow chip, I believe, is what it's called. So look a rainbow reserve, rainbow chip, those kind of things. Look for the rainbow kind of things that are going to be coming up, funny enough, matching up with all the rainbow stories that we're talking about. But that's basically going to be the trend for 2020, the 2020 harvest, which will end up being the holiday 2020 to fucking 2021. Those are going to be the rainbow things that you're going to start seeing. And what that is, the next level down, the next generation from the strawberry banana that inevitably came from the strawberry Satori. And it was during that time that, I mean, I was working the harvest season. I was doing a lot of I was trimming, I was doing some of the nug sorting and figuring the concentrates. And there were some it was interesting. It was interesting to learn about all the different like processing things, because growing up it was just border dirt weed basically. And I mean, later on when I was in jail, it was kind of funny because I mean, I ended up talking to a lot of the people in jail. You meet a lot of people in jail, believe it or not. And they were still I saw a bunch of the people that had been arrested for smuggling like bales of hay. They were bales of marijuana, but it was just that Mexican dirt weed. And It was crazy to me to see these like 200-pound fucking bales when I know that the yes, that stuff does kind of sell, but it really it doesn't sell the way that it used to. And I mean the big pot smokers have already gone medicinal because it's just more efficient. There's just better, cleaner shit. I mean, you can't get something this clean from outside of a dispensary. But they are starting to do, barrels of oil this year or last year. They started catching a bunch of people crossing the border with these giant barrels of concentrate. So they have learned now to take all those bales of hay down to this one giant barrel. And I mean, it's just efficiency and shipping really is all that is. It's something that it's one of the things that I've covered, but I try not to fully cover because I mean, personally, I have no problems with any of the cartels. I don't really give a shit what they go up to. I personally would support them doing whatever or the black market, however they want to do whatever they want to do. That's not my problem. But at the same time, it gets crazy. There's some insane things that you find out in jail, and a lot of the stories that you see in there, it's, I mean, you can't help but feel bad for anybody who's actually in jail or stuck in the prison system. I mean, the guards are awful. The system's against you. And when you're any of those, the illegal immigrants, they're basically POWs, and they get treated that way too, like they're prisoners of war. And I mean, it's an interesting thing to see as an adult. But as I got out of it, I probably should explain why I was even in jail in the first place. It was when I was in jail, it happened in between those two periods, how I transitioned into that. I'm a little high. So I was actually up in Oregon for the harvest season at the time, and then I got a letter. Basically, what happened was my blog got deleted first, and then I tried to figure out why it got deleted. I went between Blogger and WordPress. I emailed both of them, and WordPress was the only one that actually, told me anything. But it wasn't until that next Monday. It was a Friday night when everything was deleted initially, and I finally got the letter, and it was basically a takedown notice that I had lost a default judgment to an ex-boss over the leak that I had done with Bank of America for naming him. And because I had lost it, he had sued me and got a default judgment for defamation. And in doing so, I went down there, and I was fuming, and I ended up getting held in contempt of court. And so I spent 2 months, 2 non-consecutive months in Tent City in Tempe, Arizona, in Joe Arpaio's Tent City. And after I got out of there, I mean, I was already writing for the street and writing about cannabis. So, I mean, and I was going to cannabis cups and things like that. So it was a very easy transition to pitch the story to the editor of High Times. I was already, funny enough, leading up into this because I got arrested that December, but that the month before that, I was in Las Vegas for the Marijuana Business Daily conference. MJ Business Daily, Marijuana Business Conference, I think it was MJ BizCon. And it was their like second one, maybe their first one even. And that's where I met Daryl Hudson, actually. Daryl Hudson was, he's a well, drug-related scientist. He is a consultant up in Canada who got a lot of the largest grow ops going because I mean he's an extremely intelligent scientist, and he got everything set up to basically let them understand on a commercial level how to get their grow down to a what boils down to watt per square inch, and that's how they figure out like how much money it costs to get the light to grow the weed. Basically, that's how they can quantify the grow. And he also was involved in the virtual psychedelics conference that I went to recently, which is where I got this hat, the Sporing Company. Let me grab the. Here we go. So the Sporing Company is a company in Canada that's all about psychedelic research. And here is the card, so you can see the general information on it. They'll definitely have They'll say it better than I will. Let me flip it back around here. So basically, they're going through, and I mean, one of his big things, Daryl's big things, was PTSD. He worked with Sue Sisley and others who, I mean, when Sue Sisley went up to Canada, he was one of the people that was involved with that and trying to help her get her research when she couldn't get the funding from the DEA through the University of Arizona. And now that they, I mean, mushrooms have been legalized in Colorado, and they're starting to be a new thing where, I mean, now that there's been a door open for medical marijuana, people are trying to push for everything. And I don't disagree at all, actually. Because I mean, I'm a firm believer in freedom of choice, and we really should have, I mean, we know that these things can do something. There are definitely therapeutic benefits to psychedelics. I've got a whole episode on that, on YouTube anyways. I'll probably have to do another one just to get that onto Spotify and all the and iTunes and everything. By the way, if you're not aware, this podcast is available everywhere. I'm doing this on Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, Google Play. We've got approvals for everything. Going in, I don't remember what else we've got. Castbox, Breaker.com. There's about 100 different places you can find this podcast at this point. So definitely check it out. Subscribe on any of your favorite platforms. Definitely appreciate it. So yeah, and when I was at the when I was doing a lot of the drug related stuff, this is fun. I mean, this is obviously where I'm starting with my YouTube channel and my podcast and everything too, because I mean, I'm basically recreating walking through the steps of how I got to where I am. And as you can see from behind me, if you don't recognize this is Hunter S. Thompson, the father of gonzo journalism, as you will. And so, I mean, a lot of my journalism involved a lot of first-person storytelling, which is what gonzo journalism is at its heart, and then also a lot of Hunter S. Thompson-inspired drug usage. Which started to put a dividing line even further between the content that I can create for my blog and for my own personal channels, and the content that I wanted to create, the edgy, like anarchist, countercultural stuff versus what is mainstream appropriate. I mean, if you look at my YouTube channel, you'll see that dividing line very starkly illustrated, because I mean, there's a bunch of entertainment content. There's interviews with all the latest NBC shows, the stars of the latest NBC shows, and then the any of the movies from Disney, even Quibi stuff, Netflix, Amazon, any of that stuff. And then there's me talking about drugs and fucking Anonymous and hacktivism and whistleblowing and forced place insurance and all these crazy concepts and representing the Sporing Company. And I mean, that's kind of the way that it is. That's what you've got to do. You have to cater to the, I mean, that's what my whole career became, is essentially, is on one end, I'm one side, one half of me is writing for somebody else, ghostwriting or doing stuff that is commercially viable, and the other half of me is just saying what I really believe and what I think and what I want to see. And that's kind of what happens when you become a writer. When you do this for a career, you find yourself basically in this position where, I mean, you think for a living, you speak for a living, you put together words and thought and gather research and promote people. And that's how I hustle myself to make money, essentially. I mean, personally, I prefer to do that versus what putting these ads in the middle of something that I'm saying or doing these sponsored posts, even though it makes a ton of money. I mean, that's always been kind of the way that it is too. I mean, there's always been some kind of dividing line between what an artist wants to put out or a content creator of any kind of the creative work that you want to put out versus the stuff that sells and that's viable. And that's, I mean, it's that's the eternal fight, I guess, as a writer. And I try to do at least a 50-50 divide of my time. As I get older, I want to do less and less for of what I have to do for other people versus what I want to do for myself. I mean, I still do love the challenge. I'm never going to go to full 100% just wanting to say whatever the hell I want, because I mean, there is a I like the ghost writing because it does challenge me. It challenges me to continuously keep on my toes and challenge myself and learn something new and keep my brain active and keep pushing and keep fighting. Because as I get older, I mean, that's just my personal belief of death is that death happens when you stop fighting for life, and I always want to fight for life. I want to live forever. I want to live to be fucking 120 and still be doing this. So, I mean, that's why I'm trying to do it now. I'm 40 right now, so I mean, 80 years from now, I still want to be doing this fucking podcast and sitting here doing this because I do enjoy it. But at the same time, I do want to have. I mean, in order to live that long, I am going to have to contribute to other things. I have, I'm going to have to, you know, keep challenging myself and keeping my brain active because, I mean, it's having an editor is kind of on my blog, when you see what my blog actually kind of evolved into over the years, it started off as me trying to be my portfolio, me trying to prove that I knew how to be a writer and, you know, really putting in the best work I possibly could and trying to improve every day. And over time, as it became a business, what it became was like the dumping ground for any of the stuff that wouldn't get like published by anybody else. So like the equivalent of like a mixtape back in the day versus an album. All these concepts are kind of frivolous at this point and a little bit out there to try to figure out, unless they're wonky outside of the music industry, essentially, because unless you're old, because people don't really buy physical albums anymore. But having having an editor, it does help. There are times where it's nice to have another person there to kind of be a voice to stop you from sounding like an idiot sometimes, or to make you sound at your best at a bare minimum to challenge you. And I mean, inevitably you're going to have that happen. I mean, the comments are going to rip you apart if you're not on top of your game. Right now, I mean, I basically just get punished with crickets because I mean, most people have in 10 years can build some kind of an audience, but I've gone out of my way to not build an audience. I mean, I've tried to be the least approachable person, I mean, ever. That has been my goal since I became a writer. That was always the line I was writing was the difference between being recognized for what I'm doing versus just, you know, remaining in a normal life. I never wanted any kind of fame. So I mean, that's why I got into ghostwriting. It's why I always will love ghostwriting. I will always probably put my best work forward as a ghostwriter. My blog, I mean, this vlog and podcast and everything is an extension of my, I mean, overall, it's an extension of my blog, and it's an improvement of my blog at least. But it's also, I mean, inevitably, the quality is not as good as what I would sell if I were doing this professionally. Basically, this isn't something that I would give to like a client and charge them like $300 for. But if I continue doing this on, you know, the way that I'm doing it, then you know, eventually you build up an audience somewhere along the way. Someone's gonna enjoy something that I'm saying, and I mean, at that point, I don't know. Hopefully I'll be too old to care at that point. Maybe I'll actually kind of enjoy the attention when I'm older and feeble and everything. But as it stands, for at least my 40s, I'm still kind of I'm happy to be obscure is basically the way that it goes, because I just don't want people to. It sucks when everybody knows who you are. It's kind of a I don't know. It's kind of a pain. So And that's ultimately what ghostwriting does for you. It's there are not everybody that you know, I guess, is trying to be the guy on stage, basically. There are people who make their entire living as musicians, and you never know who they are, and they very much prefer it that way. They stay in studio musicians, and by the same means, not every content creator, not every creative professional is trying to get their name out there. I mean, I could give a shit less about fame. I would rather not have it. If I were better at any kind of fucking video editing, I would have figured out a long ago how to get my name removed and my face removed from all of this and not have to do that. But I mean, inevitably, this is the easiest way to get information out. I used to be a relay operator before any of this stuff. And what it was, if you're not aware of what a relay operator is, it's call 711. It's a text-to-speech, what's it called? A translator for the deaf, basically. So that anybody who wants to, who's deaf or hard of hearing and wants to make a phone call, they don't have to actually hear. They can just text it, which back in the day, it was a lot more needed of a service than it is these days because you can get text and do a lot of stuff. It's very rare that you actually need to make a phone call. But even when you do, I mean, they still do exist. You can get 711 now. It's IP relay that they do everything. But in doing that, we learned a lot about basically the speeds of how fast you can type versus how fast you can talk. And you can talk faster than you type is the short answer to all this. And there's a lot of macros that are used to type. And I mean, now they might even text to speech, depending on how good some of those things have gotten, is used for this is for closed captioning, for relay operator, all that stuff. I mean, AI even is actually probably used, and they're just at a certain point not doing much with the humans. The humans. But yeah, I mean, that's basically what we were. We were there for fodder for that to teach natural language to the, and it wasn't even natural language. It was because the syntax of American Sign Language is so different than the syntax of spoken language. I mean, American Sign Language is closer to some of the other, like Spanish and Latin-based languages, than it is American language, American talk language, we call it. American voice language. I don't know. I wonder voicies, talkies. I never really asked them what they call us, but yeah, the syntax is a little bit different. But I mean, learning those, teaching that stuff to AI is basically what any clerical job that you're doing when you're working in any kind of like transcriptions job or anything like that. And that's what I mean. Something else that I mean, I loved typing. My mom was a typist, and so I just kind of learned on old typewriters. I learned on WordPerfect back in the day when it was like the blue screen with the white and yellow text over it coming off of DOS before like Windows even existed. And I mean, we used WordPerfect, Quattro Pro, that whole Corel suite all the way through the late 90s. I didn't even get into anything Word related, Microsoft really related, until college and after, basically, because I mean, soon they took over everything. It wasn't that long, and by the time they had taken over everything, Google pretty quickly in the 2010s jumped out with their whole suite, G suite of tools. So I mean, I've learned every iteration of all these word processors, and I mean, even that, the text to speech, like the Naturally Dragoon before the text-to-speech and everything that got built into Apple and Android and Cortana and all these kind of things. Before all that stuff, I mean, I played with a lot of that stuff, so this was always kind of what I was destined to do. It wasn't like a I kind of laugh when the term ghost writer is a funny thing to me, because I mean, I rarely write. I do a lot of typing, I do a lot of talking, but I mean, it's very rarely that I sit down and like handwrite something. So I mean, like I'll sign a contract, I'll print a contract out, sign my name, and then put it through the scanner again and get it into an electric format. That's basically, I mean, my goal as a writer would be to inevitably just have to sign my name, and that's all I have to do to make any kind of money. But I mean, it all it all matters of whether or not I Again, I mean, you have to have some level of notoriety, at least, much less fame, in order to sign something like that and have it go up in value. But on the whole, that's the goal of this podcast. It's the goal of what I'm doing, to explore and explain why I'm a ghostwriter, so that I have other revenue streams by the end of this. Because as it turns out, a lot of people either don't or can't read. I'm not sure, but well, both. And I mean, when you write, you're catering to such a small demographic, because not only do they have to read, they have to want to read what it is that you're talking about, and then they have to be able to find you. I mean, there's just so many fucking variables into that are narrowing down how much of an audience you can get on a written word versus me talking into this microphone and or these microphones and putting this podcast out to, as many different video and audio channels as I can. Because, I mean, it's you reach a bigger audience that way, inevitably. That's just the way that it is. There are more people that will turn on any kind of video and just tune shit out than there are who will read. And I mean, I'm probably never going to be on. I have already, but I'm never going to be on radio or TV on my own show, I guess, on my own terms like this. So, I mean, inevitably, these, as much as it sucks that the content that you make for iTunes or Google Play or YouTube, it's the same basic grind as what you're doing in blogging anyways, regardless of what it is. It's all content creation, and it doesn't make a difference if you're doing it for media, for marketing, for entertainment. It doesn't make a difference. It's all content creation. So, I mean, I have the same struggles that somebody like fucking Stevie Wonder had, or not Steve, Ray Charles was, well, Stevie Wonder, any fucking musician really, but Ray Charles, when he was fighting for control of his masters, Lil Wayne, Taylor Swift. I have the same problems that they do. Let me clarify that real fucking quick, because there are a lot of different problems that we all have. Why, mostly money related, that where they have a shit ton of money and I do not, and that comes with its problems. But those any content creator, from like a hardcore independent journalist like Barrett Brown, who's doing this for just to see the fucking world burn, and from him all the way to like Brad Pitt, who's the epitome of fucking Hollywood on every end, old school Hollywood. Like, no matter who it is, these content creators, they're all the same. They're creating content, and they have the same bullshit to deal with publishers, with editors, with creative control, with all sorts of problems that come up with any time that you put anything out in public. You're just gonna deal with a bunch of crap. I mean, it's funny, because Eminem had one person break a window in his home, and it made the news. But I mean, he had already talked about it in his own songs, that he had to move from, or first he wanted to put up a giant fence, and when he was living in Detroit area, then he moved it from there to Hollywood, where it was more suited to his level of fame. And I mean, he wrote a song, Stan. He already knew that all this stuff was happening. This stuff has always been happening. That's just been his life. Is when you talk online, I mean, I've had it happen on a much, much lower level, but I've had the same thing happen, where people will just scrape my content, take some shit out of context, and try to make it look like I'm some fucking insane guy or some crazy shit. Make it, I mean, you can at this point do a deep fake of me, of as much content as I put out online. And it, I don't know. That's why I stick to ghostwriting as much as possible. That's why I always have, because I've always been more comfortable having somebody else that really wanted to have their face out there, put their name on everything, and just, writing the ideas. I was still able to spread my ideas. I was still able to get everything that I needed done out of it. It's just kind of like using a puppet. Like, you didn't have to be the face to do all that stuff. And by doing that, you avoid all the crazy fucking people. Because I mean, I have gotten death threats. I've gotten Jesus, at least a dozen of them since I've started writing and putting my name out there, because any idea that you have, somebody is pissed. Somebody really does not agree with that idea. I mean, right now it's as simple as like, do you want the country open or do you want everyone to stay home wearing masks and spraying fucking Lysol everywhere? And there's a nice median in between both, but I mean the if you come out there as one or the other side immediately jumps down your throat. That's what Anonymous was initially designed for. That's why I started with Anonymous when I started doing all of this activism, this writing, and anything that I was doing online. I started with Anonymous and I started in ghostwriting because, I mean, the anonymity is a luxury that, I mean, there are a lot of people that wish they could be anonymous. Ask any billionaire. Most of the billionaires do not want people to know that they're billionaires. I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive. If I were a billionaire, I would want nobody to know. Everybody would say that. I mean, I don't want anybody to fucking know, but people will figure it the fuck out pretty quickly and put you on the cover of magazines. And now, like, you've got to get security. You're a billionaire, but you've got to spend at least $1 million of it on security. You've got the same problems that Tekashi 6ix9ine or Pop Smoke had. Like, you're just gonna get fucking shot by putting your face out there. And I mean, that's why I've always preferred ghostwriting. And when you ask any ghostwriter, they're happy to be a ghostwriter. When Meek Mill and Funk Flex and all that were going after Drake for ghostwriting, that Quentin Miller, what I think his name was, whatever his name was, that he was very quick to try to push that spotlight off of him. He did not want people looking at him. And it wasn't just because he had an NDA, because obviously he had an NDA too. Like, that was part of it. He did not want to speak on it because clearly he had signed an NDA. But at the same time, like, I mean, he could have made an exception, figured out whatever the hell he wanted, and come out and made his own fucking career if he really wanted to do it. But that wasn't where he was trying to go, and he was very humble about it, because there are people out there that's what they prefer to be. They prefer to be the guy who's behind the scenes, who has someone else in front of him to kind of take all the heat. And I mean, everybody that you've ever seen something from, they've used a ghostwriter at least once. Everybody has. Everybody has at some point or another used one. Some of the bigger authors, like James Patterson, is very I guess notorious would be the word, well known for using ghostwriters. There's co-writers and all sorts of other things like that. But I mean, it's easy to, on the other end of it, to kind of be mad. I'm like, oh man, this guy's taking the credit for something that somebody else said. But when you're actually that guy, when you're the ghostwriter, you kind of you relish it in a way. You there's a reason that you're doing it, and everything has a purpose. But at the end of the day, I personally, I still like my anonymity. I still like the idea. The only reason I do this at this point is because I've been fucking socially distancing for the last decade, basically. I mean, I've gone out of my way to basically avoid people. So, I mean, at this point, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, I'm staying out of everybody's way no matter what. So, it is what it is. Come at me, bro. Yeah, that's basically. I mean, I pay most of my bills off of ghostwriting. That's pretty much my main income at any given moment. There's very rarely. I mean, the most, I guess, the closest that it ever got was a 50-50 split when I was working at Crypto Briefing. When I was doing the cryptocurrency stuff, and actually the cannabis stuff, I guess that was a good 50-50 split too, of my income was coming from like, where half my income was coming from stuff that I was writing under my own name versus stuff that I was doing for ghostwriting. But I always leaned into ghostwriting because it was just easier, and it always is going to be easier. I have a few markets that I'm working with right now, marketplaces. If you ever want to hire me as a ghostwriter, go to Writer's Access, go to scripted.com. You can request me right on there, and you can find me pretty easily. I prefer the marketplaces at this point because it's easier for both the customer and for me because I don't always have time or even really particularly want to work on a million freaking projects even when I do have time. And so I like to pass some of that stuff on to other people who are just as qualified. I would go through the time of building my own stable of writers. I've had people, tell me to go that route too, but I've also worked with enough of these writing stables and writing farmers, I guess, content mills, that I understand what it's like to have an army of ghostwriters now, and I don't really want to have that kind of pressure of management. That's what I walked away from corporate America, I guess, to get away from. I wasn't trying to build anything like some massive fucking. That's the difference, I guess. There's people that want to build a movement, and I mean, I am doing my own little movement my own way, but I mean, it was never my intent. I just wanted to get away from corporate America, get away from the fucking politics, get away from the grind and the game. And now that I do play, I mean, you can't avoid it. It's unavoidable. You just have to get political and play the game every once in a while. But now I do it under my own, I guess my own fruition, my own freedom, my own everything. I get full benefit and consequence of it. And it's my own path that I'm walking at this point, which is really what I wanted out of all of that, was to walk my own path. If that's the biggest thing that you get out of it. I mean, you lose all the comfort, you lose a lot of safety nets when you go into any kind of content creation or creative profession, but ultimately it's the freedom that you get, the freedom of choice and thought and everything else that makes it worth it. And that's why I keep on doing it, and I would do it for life. Right behind all of this, to fund me having fun in the talking about non-commercial friendly shit. So yeah, that's pretty much why I do what I do, and how I got into ghostwriting. If you want to learn more about the whistleblowing aspect, you can go back to the previous podcast, previous episode, and the next episode, I will most likely dive into more about the marketing end of this, the free product reviews, and how I got into the influencer side, and how all of that is working, kind of a post-COVID-19 era, because I've already have been taking kind of a break from all that stuff, and it's gonna be fun to dive into all of that again. But I mean, marketers are already pulling back on that too. I mean, the ad revenues are down across the board, so it's not really just me doing it, me not doing it. A bunch of people are not doing it, and not all of them are not doing it voluntarily. Was that too many negatives in one sentence? Anyway. So that'll be next episode. Tomorrow night, more than likely. I might wait another night, but most likely it'll be tomorrow night. I'll jump on and do all that. And then yeah, from there we're gonna dive into some of the more wonky topics and cryptocurrency and vaping and cannabis and ghostwriting activism, writing, all the bullshit that I've been involved in for the last 10 years, and we'll be involved in for fucking 80 more if I'm lucky, because I'm planning to live to be 120. Anyway, this is Brian Penny, and I hope you've had a wonderful time listening to this, and have a wonderful rest of your night. As always, check out any of the sponsors and any of the videos and any of the links, and check me out on iTunes, on Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, shit, Twitter, Pinterest, pretty much fucking everywhere. Just look up Brian Penny. You'll find me. Pretty easy to find. And anyway, hope you have a wonderful day.